At this time, brothers and sisters, we offer up our prayers to God. Is there a microphone? There it is. Thank you. So if there are prayers that you wish to offer, personal petitions of joy or concern, this is the time to do so, not just
our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Nothing says vacation to me like a jigsaw puzzle. So in preparation for our family reunion last week, our granddaughter Anne and I went to find a new puzzle. Though she is 9, we decided that we were all ready for a 1,000-piece challenge. There were 17 of us. Some are avid puzzlers, some lukewarm, others spatially challenged and not at all interested. I fall in the first category. That may be a surprise to you, along with my daughters-in-law and one grandson who is 7. With the attendant chaos that is inherent in family gatherings, we would remove ourselves periodically for a little puzzle therapy. We finished the puzzle the day before they all left. Well, almost. There was a piece missing. It seems that another grandparent from another wing of the family once thought it a good joke to abscond with a piece. Days later, he mailed it back with a note saying, "Were you looking for this?" No wonder we divorced. It was cruel and vicious and resonated deeply with the grandchildren, who now think it a super trick. So when we came up one piece short, accusatory glares and pointing fingers turned immediately to the grandkids, who, by the way, quickly denied any such malfeasance. The puzzle sat on our dining room table, neatly complete, but for the tiny gaping hole in the center. I was intrigued by how incredibly powerful that one little piece was, because without it, you pretty much have to chuck the puzzle. You can't put it away with a sticky note that says, "Beware, one piece missing," because no one would ever compulsively look for a particular piece again. They'd think, "Well, I won't focus on that piece because it might be the missing one." One's commitment to the puzzle would be minimal at best. Why invest in something you can't trust? Why spend any time working on something that is not reliable? And behind this, there is also a certain level of deceit, a sense that we've been robbed of satisfaction and the great joy of communal completion, of reaching a common goal. So it was with the wandering Israelites, descendants of Abraham and Sarah, who, filled with faith and the promises of God, sought the promised land, but never got there. With their eyes on the prize, they looked forward and never back. Filled with hope, they walked in faith towards God together. As we heard, and this is a slightly different translation, all these died in faith, without having received the promises, but from a distance they saw and greeted them. They confessed that they were strangers and foreigners on earth. For people who speak in this way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of the land that they had left behind, they would have had ample opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country. That is a heavenly one, seeking a homeland. Isn't this essentially what we are all doing? I don't mean that we're hoping to find suitable housing. I'm talking about a home in the deepest and most elemental and eternal sense. I'm talking about God. Do we know that we are on this quest? Are we aware that there is part of us that feels, as the writer of Hebrews says, that we are strangers and foreigners on earth? When everything is stripped away, when we envision ourselves without all the encumbrances of our lives, when we envision ourselves perhaps as even literal refugees, what would we be longing for? Safety, perhaps security, love, most of all. Many of us are very fortunate and might even say that our lives are pretty replete with love and safety and security already. We have in different ways carved out existences that are comfortable and satisfying. We are, after all, the most privileged people on earth. But if we are honest, if we allow ourselves in the quiet moments before rising, before the world has had its way with us and we have mounted the treadmill of time, we might feel in our souls a longing too deep for words. And what we are longing for, ironically, is something I think in the farthest reaches of our memories and fibers of our being we know well. It is from whence we've come and to where ultimately we are going. It is, of course, God. When our daughter Eliza was born, Charlie and I saw this with crystal clarity. I've had 5 babies, and each birth was as miraculous a moment as I think we are given in this life. It was what happened after Eliza was born that brought us to our knees. For about 20 minutes after delivery, Eliza lay wide-eyed in our arms and just looked around. She didn't squirm or wiggle. Nothing in her body seemed to be demanding her attention or reaction. She was, without doubt, the most serene human being I have ever seen, before or since. She radiated a peace and tranquility that was not of this world. She simply wasn't here yet. She came trailing heaven's Milky Way like a star spun out of orbit, wrapped in gossamer wings, and laid gently in our earthly quivering arms. It didn't last. After 20 minutes, her stomach called. The light was too bright, and her eyes clenched shut, and the door banged, and she jumped and turned inward for protection and insulation from the outside clamor. She was consumed by her body's adjusting to gravity and touch and earth. She joined the human race and started the long trek home again. How much do you think about heaven? Do you even call it heaven? Out on an early morning walk last week, one of our grandchildren asked me at 5:45 a.m., what happens when we die? Believe me, that will sure get your brain out of bed. How would you have answered? Ultimately, I think we are headed home. Back, if you will, and forward to God. And though I honestly can't envision a merit system where good people reap rewards summarily handed out by whomever or whatever, I do wonder if the way we live our lives affects our understanding of the eternal, both now and then. Jesus says, as we just heard, "Do not be afraid, little flock, for it is God's good pleasure to give you the dominion." And I have to say, whenever I hear these words, "Do not be afraid, little flock," my eyes mist up. Because, of course, we are afraid, if we dare admit it. And we wonder about God and how good we're being, thinking mostly, I think, that we're not being good enough or giving enough or generous enough. And to call all of us here gathered with our motley mix of tears and laughter and strengths and weaknesses, buildings and budgets, and the sometimes boring business of being a church, to call us a little flock just makes everything okay. And I do feel like a lamb looking for my shepherd, which I think is what is being implied in the Hebrew passage. If we live our lives focused on the one who loves and guides us and protects and feeds us, if we keep our ears cocked and our eyes alert, we are already attuned to the divine. But God asks something of us as well, asks that we listen and pay attention and mirror God's generosity to us in our relationship with others. This week, I happened to run into a member of our congregation as I was trying to get to this sermon, and I made some flippant remark about needing to write and having a hard time getting there, and I said, well, maybe I'll just give the basic sermon, God loves you, be nice, and call it a day. To which he astutely added, now get with the program. I thought, that's the clincher, isn't it? We may be God's precious little flock, but we live as members of the human race, interdependent, joined by God's love, blessed with time on earth to serve and to love, to connect not only with each other, but with the essence of God's grace. We get intimations of heaven, mostly, I think, through love and care and service to others. We have been told repeatedly to love our neighbors as ourselves, to give as freely as we have been given, and to do this not, we do this not just to help others. We do this to save ourselves, to save us from recklessness and greed, from self-absorption and complacency, from sorrow and grief. This is how we receive intimations of heaven, how we enter a dimension that makes whatever is eternal more accessible. On earth, as it is in heaven, we say every week. And do we mean it? Does this suggest that when we die, we might recognize grace and peace a little better? That the peace which passes all understanding might actually just be a little familiar to us? I certainly don't know, but I do trust in God's love and faith for us. There are times in all our lives when we feel we've slipped into another dimension, when we feel connected to something greater than us, to God, to Jesus. We are moved by others also who exemplify this commitment and sacrifice. Last month, Senator Christopher Murphy from Connecticut filibustered on the Senate floor for 15 hours in support of stricter gun laws. He told the story of Dylan Hockley, who died in the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. Dylan was 6 years old, and he was on the autism spectrum. He was a charming, sweet little boy who idolized his brother Ryan and especially his aide, Anne Marie Murphy, incidentally, no relation to the senator. She had been such a positive force in Dylan's life, and he adored her. Prominently displayed on their refrigerator was her picture. Senator Murphy was with Dylan's parents that fateful day in Newtown, with them when they heard that Dylan wouldn't be coming out of the school alive. But what he learned also was that Anne Marie had clearly gone to Dylan in the midst of utter chaos and wrapped him in her arms and put herself directly in the line of fire, so that what Dylan knew in his last moment was love and not fear. This is an intimation of the divine, a moment in this life that is infused with heaven. Our lives are filled with opportunities to experience this grace. All it takes is courage and love. Just that, which is, of course, everything. But it is only when we reach out from our personal shelters, whatever they may be, of fear, or overcommitment, or busyness, or self-absorption, or privilege, or loneliness, or addiction, only when we connect with those in need and offer whatever it is that we have, that we pave our way to God in this world and the next. The day after our family left, one of the grandkids confessed to hiding the missing piece of the puzzle. He'd buried it outside in a basement window well. We retrieved it and finished the puzzle. It looked so much better, as if it gave a great sigh of relief, and I marveled again at how one little piece can make such a difference. And so, of course, it is with us, because until there is peace for all, there is only partial, insecure peace for any. May we search for the missing piece in our lives, for that heavenly home from which we came and to which we are going, resplendent on earth as it is in heaven. Grace and peace, my friends. And now we offer our gifts to God for the support of Christ's church in the world. The offering now will be given and received.